Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bien, je vais inviter maintenant Gérald Bennett à venir nous rejoindre. Gérald, vous l'avez entendu, a été directeur d'un département qui s'appelait Diagonale. Donc Gérald est un personnage diagonale. Et voilà, on a tous de multiples dimensions, y compris dans les diagonales. Vous avez eu beaucoup de matrices dans les diapositives depuis hier. Gérald Bennett a donc été très trop associé dès 1971, vous vous rendez compte, à l'IRCAM. Et il a été aussi fondateur et il est l'ancien directeur de l'Institute of Computer Music and Sound Technology et c'est l'Université des Arts de Zurich, qui n'est pas n'importe quoi. Donc Gérald va nous plonger dans une des œuvres dont Andrew nous a parlé, c'est Anthem 2, et il va nous révéler ou nous expliquer comment l'œuvre a une importance particulière pour la conviction que Boulez avait que sa musique pourrait ne plus être athématique, ce qui était un tournant ou un turning point important. Je le laisse mettre au point la technologie. Et ça va arriver.
For months, I looked forward to presenting this this talk in French. I dreamt of it. I worked at it. But finally, I had to discover that old age simply did not let me have ideas when I was working in French. And I apologize for speaking in English. That's how it is. I will speak about the final composition Pierre Boulez completed before his death, Anthem 2, for solo violin and electronics. First performed in October 1997 at the Donaueschingen Festival. Strictly speaking, the time of the piece's composition barely qualifies it to be discussed at this colloquium about the years 1975 to 1995, but Andrew Gershow tells us in the manual accompanying the score that Boulez had the idea to compose the work in 1995. Because Anthem 2 is very different from the rest of Boulez's oeuvre, it seemed important to me to address these differences here. Anthem 2 is the expansion of a piece for solo violin, Anthem, written for the Concours International Yehudi Menuhin de la Ville de Paris, and first performed in November 1991 at a birthday celebration for Alfred Schley, the former director of the Universal Edition. This is the title page of what later became Anthem 1, which I will not discuss further, but I'm showing it to you because the page shows an important detail, and that is the date of the concert here, which is a palindrome. And this is a principle that Boulez makes frequent use of in Anthem 2. After the composition of Anthem 2, the original piece was re-entitled Anthem 1. Boulez says in his important discussion with Peter Sandy on the occasion of the French first performance of Anthem 2 in 1997, and here I will let you read in French the example, so you don't have to deal with my horrible accent. Leaving aside the question of how true this is, the sonatine for flute and visage nuptial, for example, are certainly composed using themes, we should know that in his discussion with Sandy, Boulez is unusually open and frank about his intentions in the Anthem. In fact, most of which of what we know directly from Boulez about Anthem 2 can be found in this discussion, as if it were important to him to give us some access to the composition. I would like to consider a few passages of Anthem 2. Some technical detail is helpful to understand the composition and in particular to have insight into the role of the electronic accompaniment. In the discussion with Sandy, Boulez speaks of singing the Gregorian Lamentations of Jeremiah during Holy Week when he was young. Here you see the score of the Gregorian Lamentations. It is easy to see the form of the music. The verses are numbered by Hebrew letters, and a Latin verse, and a Hebrew letter, and the next verse, and a Hebrew letter. And you see that the Hebrew letters are all floridly composed. Alehehehef, behehehehet. Whereas the verses are syllabically composed. So you have an immediate overview of the form of the piece, which goes on for quite a while. I've just given you one page. In Anthème 2, Boulez takes this plan, this idea. In Anthème 2, these roles are reversed. The letters, what are letters here, are simple harmonics in the violin, and the following verses are very florid, but the form is as clear as in the Gregorian chant. The chant laments the destruction of Jerusalem and the first temple by the Babylonians in 586 before the Christian era. The text of the beginning of the chant contains the title of my talk, Civitas Facta Est Quasi Vidua. The city, Jerusalem, is become as a widow. I chose this title because I could not imagine so sensitive a reader as Boulez modeling a composition's form on that of such a highly significant text without some reference to the text's spirit. Here in contrast is the beginning of the score of Anthème 2, showing first the introduction. And then I'll show you the next page where you can see a letter and the beginning of a verse. Just a comment on the score to help you read it. This is the solo violin part. And these are the electronic instruments that play along. I'll show you the next page. This is the letter, the equivalent of the Hebrew letter. It looks like a low note, but in fact it's a high note on the violin. And this is the beginning of the first verse. Solo violin and the electronic instruments, about which I'll say something just a minute. Let's listen. This is the introduction to the whole work. Hello. The end of this example is actually very important. We'll hear it again at the end of the composition. And now the continuation. I have a constant war with PowerPoint. So this follows immediately the introduction. This is the letter separating the introduction and the verse. and so forth. The introduction, which we heard, leads us to a melody in the violin like no melody in the entire corpus of Pierre Boulez's compositions since his youth. A melody whose accented notes suggest a G minor, C minor tonality, and whose falling motives and insistently swaying rhythms suggest lamentation. A melody overburdened by weeping trills, whose phrase structure is quite classical, not to say conventional. A melody, in short, which sounds completely out of place in a work by Pierre Boulez. The melody is accompanied by electronic harmonizers and significantly by pizzicati of an electronic sampler. The accompaniment contributes to the music's strangeness. For what role do plucked instruments have to play in these solemn surroundings? Variants of this music with the same motifs and the same pizzicato accompaniment appear three more times in the first half of the piece, always introduced by letter signals. After the middle of the piece, neither the letter signal nor the lamenting theme is heard again. This music is not found in En Thème 1. It appears not to have been part of the original idea for the piece, but to have become important enough to be used four times in the expanded piece. The constant return to the note G, the falling figure as upbeat to the repeated note, the swaying rhythm, the simple phrase structure, the trills on almost every longer note, all these elements show us unmistakably that the melody is singing a lament, albeit an exaggerated one. But who or what is being lamented? What happened before the piece began? We never learn the reason for lamentation and its presence at the beginning of En Thème, and its presence at the beginning of En Thème 2 overshadows the remaining composition, like a dissonance only finding resolution but without yielding its secret at the end of the piece. There is another reference in the music, not so obvious as the lament characteristic of the melody. The pizzicato string notes of the sampler give us the clue, and we recognize the sound of the serenade in the classical opera, where strings imitate a guitar or lute accompanying a single singer. Here, given the solemn mode of the lament, it is unlikely that we are listening to a serenade. But in classical opera, there are occasions near the beginning of a drama where the main character sings alone of her or his private, intimate feelings, as would not be possible in the presence of other characters of the opera. This is the cavatina. What interest would Boulez have in awakening associations with the cavatina in a piece for solo violin and electronics? The exaggerated reference to the cavatina suggests that this is a personal, private lament, but it also suggests that the listener has been invited, if not to an opera, at least to a theatrical event. In the discussion with Peter Sandy, Boulez speaks about this characteristic of En Thème 2, that there is something over which the violinist has no control, refers obviously to the electronic accompaniment, but may also very well make reference to the mystery of the lament at the beginning of the piece, over which only the composer has control. In the course of the piece, the lament's darkness colors every phrase of the music like the presence of a subcutaneous wound, only to find resolution in the piece's long conclusion and the return to the final D, the first note of any duration heard at the beginning of the piece. The presentation of the lament is interrupted by the next letter. A single pianissimo harmonic leading to the following verse, which could hardly be a greater contrast to the lament. Very fast, very loud pizzicati, accompanied of all things by canonic repetition of these same pizzicati. I'll play you this example now first, and we'll look at the score afterwards. It's the letter. So forth. That goes on for quite a while. In the discussion with Sandy, Boulez says, for his important book, Jonathan Goldman consulted Boulez's sketches in the Paul Zacher Foundation to show in detail how the compression Boulez speaks of is realized. We also saw the same example with Andrew's talk just a few minutes ago. The violin plays a three-part canon forced into one part, a favorite technique often used by Boulez. We find the original canonic violin part already in Anthème 1. In Anthème 2, the accompaniment to this compressed canon uses the canon itself as one voice of a complex counterpoint, crowned by pizzicati that often use the palindrome of the date of Alfred Schley's birthday. And here's the score of this section. I'm only showing you one page, but we can see most of the elements here. This is the letter, of course. This, in the violin, is the three-part canon that Andrew showed us just a few minutes ago. It continues also for quite a while. Now, what's more difficult to see here is that there is a microphone recording the violin canon, and the canon is being sent to six electronic devices which play the sound back later after certain delays and transpose each repetition of the canon. So in fact, here you can't see it in the score, but there is a seven-part counterpoint, canonic counterpoint going on. This music begins, and then repetitions, canonic repetitions and transpositions follow. As if that weren't enough, we have here, and this happens frequently in the course of the passage, we have here a pizzicato sound which has in its rhythmic values, shows in its rhythmic values, the palindrome we saw on the page of Anthème 1. Here, if you count the, what we in America call 16th, if you count the double croche, you have 3-1-2-1-3. And this kind of pattern is used often in the successive, in the continuation of the canon. Boulez composed here a sort of super canon, which is contrapuntally the densest moment of the composition. The contrast between the exaggerated lament and the monstrous pizzicato compression is enormous and is one of the forces propelling the work to its conclusion 18 minutes later, where all contrasts are resolved. It is significant that Boulez places these two exaggerated references to the musical past, the intimate cavatina and the solemn but abstract canon, next to each other at the beginning of the piece, as if to underline the piece's connection with music of the past. The music of lament occurs altogether four times in the course of the first half of Anthème 2. We hear it and the letter music for the last time at the end of this section, almost precisely in the middle of the piece. I would like now to consider the very long penultimate section of En Thème 2, which begins almost precisely at the golden mean of the piece. It uses four strongly contrasting, easily recognizable themes with their associated accompaniments. In its uncompromising radicality and its mystery, this section illustrates one aspect of thematic composition which apparently deeply interested Boulez. Here are the four themes. I've numbered them with Roman numerals. We'll hear these examples, or hear these themes. The themes follow each other in unpredictable fashion for the next astonishing 5.5 minutes, or for more than one quarter of the length of the entire En Thème 2. Each thematic appearance differs only in duration from the next. The themes remain surprising in their order and adamantly refuse to tell a story. Like the mystery of lamenting and mourning at the beginning of En Thème 2, this long section does not yield any information about the meaning or importance of the themes which populate it. But the section clearly becomes the emotional center of the piece, precisely because of the unyielding quality of the themes themselves, their incompatibility with each other, the mystery of their origin, and the insistence with which the composer repeats them. By refusing to disclose the origin or meaning of the themes, Boulez leaves us with the memory of strong emotion rather than an explanation of this emotion. And the more often we hear these mysterious and disturbing fragments, apparent witnesses of some dramatic and possibly violent event, the stronger our expectation becomes to learn something about their meaning and to resolve our own uncertainty. In the discussion with Peter Sonti, speaking about the use of signals in En Thème 2, Boulez tells us, in En Thème 2, Boulez manipulates his listeners by making these signals anything but neutral. On the contrary, by shaping them like fragments of the civitas facta quasi vidua, arousing our curiosity, our concern, and our desire for clarity and resolution. There is another manipulation in En Thème 2 about which I will speak in a moment, but here it is worthwhile to reflect once more on Boulez's use of themes, who for so many years vehemently defended athematic composition in his music. René Char wrote 50 years earlier, "Seules les traces font rêver." And traces and not proofs give access to the less conscious areas of the perception and the mind. Later in his life, as we know from the Collège de France lectures, Boulez became more interested in these areas than he had been earlier, particularly in the importance of the perception. And he, always the master of discretion, became bolder in his willingness to speak about them in and through his music. Finally, a word about the marvelous conclusion of En Thème 2. The idea of the final section is that all the richness of the violin's music be reduced to one D, Ré, the note with which the piece began. That's why I asked you to pay particular attention to the introduction. This is not done by slowing the melodic movement, which astonishingly remains as rapid as in the entire piece, but rather by reducing the range and dynamics of the violin's music until only the D remains, first played with a trill, then the trill sul tasto, then the tone non vibrato, and finally as a harmonic with even less timbre. In his discussion with Sandy, Boulez says of this ending, listen now to the entire conclusion, a somewhat longer example than the others I've given. Sorry, I won't take the time to attach the power supply. I beg your pardon. I simply wanted to say it ends with the same D that it began with. Boulez emphasizes here the closure of the act of theater, which opened with lament and mourning seemingly so long ago. This is the final manipulation to which Boulez subjects us before releasing us to marvel at the richness we have experienced and at the distance we have traveled. In all tempter, I apologize again for not having given you the end. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.